Thank you for being here. It is 8:31, and we are going to get going because I've already had to cut more out of this lecture than I wanted to. The 45 minutes is just painful. So this is session two of a two-lecture series of Scripture and the Human Being, a proposal for the biblical hermeneutic of Landon Saunders. If you weren't here yesterday, I'm very sorry, but we are going to have a the teeniest of reviews, and then we're going to barrel ahead. So I believe the recording of it, the audio of it, will be up, and I hope you will go back and listen to that, because yesterday we spent time looking at the assumptions and the driving questions that Landon Saunders, over the last 40 plus years of his work and his ministry, have brought to the text. So some of what we talked about yesterday had to do with just what in the world hermeneutics is, right? Hermeneutics is essentially just where you're standing when you try to make meaning or understand something. When you try to make sense of your world or something you encounter, then what are the assumptions you bring to that? So let's imagine, that there was an exit sign, right back up there on the wall, and I said, okay, what's your hermeneutic for that exit sign? And you say, that is the stupidest question I have ever heard, because all I am doing is just looking at that exit sign. Well, actually, you're not, right? When you look at that exit sign, you are bringing to that exchange the fact that you are recognizing that those lines are actually letters, and they're letters in a particular language. And when you put those letters together, they make sounds according to that language, right? And those sounds come together to make a word, and that word means something. And in fact, it means something different on that wall than it would mean if it was on a sign off of a freeway, right? Mm-hmm. So you're actually making sense of something as simple as that, right? So we're doing it all the time. And those assumptions that I bring about what language is, what that exit sign means in that context, right? Think of all the things you would have to explain to someone in order for them to understand that sign the way you understand that sign, right? So this is all what we're talking about with hermeneutics. So when we apply that to a biblical text, when we apply that to someone like Landon's work, and we want to get, what are the lines he's seeing, right? What are the letters those lines are making? What does those sounds sound like to him, right, in order to make sense of that and make meaning? So we can figure out where he stands. So that's what we did yesterday. Where does he stand? And we went through, what I did to prepare for this is I went through about 10 years of his most public lectures and pulled together many of his theological assumptions. There are a number of them. We didn't have time to go through them all, but I walked through the ones that I felt like were most beneficial for what we're trying to accomplish. And we came to this point. So these are the assumptions that we laid out at the end of class yesterday. So first we started with, what is Scripture? What is the Bible for Landon? That the Bible is a guide, right? A sacred space that we inhabit that orients us towards what? For Landon, towards what it means to be fully human and how to be with another human being. All human beings are created in the image of God, right? Without exception. This sacred essence is common to all humanity, although our existence has caused us to be estranged from that essence. Jesus overcame that estrangement by showing us how to be fully human within the constraints of existence, right? All right? And then we become fully human then through Jesus. We imitate his humanity by learning how to be present with other human beings like Jesus was present for transformation. The human being in the world is of central importance to God, to Jesus, and therefore to us. Nothing in Landon's hermeneutic takes precedence over the human being. The greatest gift Jesus gave to humanity was the gift of his presence. I remember that very dramatic line that we looked at from one of Landon's speeches where he says, the greatest gift, I don't think it was his birth. I don't think it was his death or resurrection. It was the gift of his presence. And all of those other things go into that presence. Understanding the text requires being engaged with the present world. And this is the last thing we came to, right? We read the world. Not the world. We read the text through the lens of the world, okay? So we're used to reading the world through the lens of the text. So, and we looked quickly at an example of how Landon sees the story of the adulterous woman, where he, the people who came with rocks in their hands, they were reading scripture, and they read her through the text, right? They read the text and then saw her through it. And by doing that, they picked up rocks, and they were right, right? But Landon says, no, that's not what Jesus does. We read the text through her. So all those commandments, right, we don't get to them until we see her first. And when we see her first, Jesus doesn't pick up a rock, right? And the same thing, the text is read through the lens of the world, through the lens of the human being. I know I'm going quickly and I apologize. So then we looked at these driving questions of what that Landon takes to the text. And Landon says, you go to the text and you cling to these two questions as hard as you can, right? For dear life, you hang on to these two questions when you go into a text. What does it mean to be a human being? And what does it mean to be with another human being, right? And that is how he reads. And one of the reasons why we spent so much time on this is because those of you who know Landon's work, when he came back from those 80 countries and he had on his trip and he started going to the outsider and he started not carrying his Bible with him to speak in fire halls and those kinds of places, and he started not using the word God and not using the word Jesus, and people said Landon has lost it. They said he's not even reading the Bible, right? He's not reading scripture. But I hope that yesterday we started to make clear that Landon is, in fact, absolutely reading scripture. He's just reading it with a different hermeneutic. And the last thing we did yesterday was we came to this. We talked about the way that biblical studies often separates these hermeneutics, right? These sets of assumptions and questions. And they divide them in these three broad categories of behind the text, right? So understanding meaning is located behind the text, right? So the original context, what it meant in its original context, what it would have meant to the original audience, what it would have meant in the mind of the person who wrote it, right? All of those kinds of questions that get to that behind the text readings. In the text readings are questions about the structure of the text, narrative, those kinds of things. That's where meaning is. How can we see how these pieces of narrative and text fit together to make a particular point? And then this third way is in front of the text reading that privileges, prioritizes the perspective of the real flesh and blood reader as that reader interacts with the text in her own lived context. Right? So if you were to take that to different methodologies, you would find behind the text, historical critical, like those kinds of methods. If you were in the text, you would see narrative theory and discourse analysis. If you're in front of the text, you are going to come to socioeconomic criticism, feminist theory and criticism, African-American criticism, where we take seriously the flesh and blood present location of the reader. For where meaning is located, the meaning that is located, the meaning that is made sense of in that space. And you can see that Landon is firmly in that spot, which should explain a lot why there was a lot of tension between what he was doing in the 70s and what our tradition and many other traditions were doing. because most of our traditions were located back behind.
Or the text itself.
Or the text itself, or behind. They were focused there. And Landon was focused here. And in that way, he was a part of a postmodern criticism of locking the text in the past so that it can't speak to the present. Okay? So I think we're kind of caught up. That was as fast as I could do it. So what I want to do today is I want to make a few suggestions about how we can see how Landon is reading in an actual text. Now, first, I want to spend just a few minutes thinking about Landon's claim that the reason he reads text the way that he does, privileging the perspective of the flesh and blood reader in her own real lived context, reading through the human being, right? Reading through the world, that's necessary for understanding. The reason he does that is because that's how Jesus reads his scripture. So, we're going to take a couple of minutes here and just see if that hangs together. All right? Now, unfortunately, we cannot go comprehensively through all of this as much as I want to. So we're just going to get a taste of it. And we're going to do it with the Gospel of Mark because I'm the one speaking and that one's my favorite. So starting here, just right at the beginning, we're going to start with this text. We're in Mark chapter 2, verses 23 through 28. I'm going to read it for the benefit of those who are listening. So one Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields, and as they made their way, his disciples began to pluck heads of grain. The Pharisees said to him, "Look, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" And he said to them, "Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry and in need of food? He entered the house of God when Abiathar was high priest, and he ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and he gave some to his companions. Then he said to him, 'The Sabbath was made for humankind, and not humankind for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath.'" Now, this is right here at the beginning of Mark's text, and it's pretty much the first place we see Jesus directly interact with his scripture. Now, just as a little side caveat, what we think of the canon and how that was put together for the scripture in Jesus' time and place, super complicated issue. We're just going to put a pin in that. You guys can look at that later. But he is reading this as scripture, right? And he is referring to a text from 1 Samuel. Right? It's 1 Samuel 21. It is a text where David goes into this sacred space and says, "Hey, I need supplies for me and my men. Let's have some bread or whatever else you've got." And the priest, high priest, says, "All I have is this bread of the presence," right? And David says, "Okay, we'll take that," right? This is sort of the story that's laying behind what Jesus is referring to here. Now, the Pharisees are accusing him of a legal violation of the Sabbath, right? So us good Church of Christers in our Sunday morning class, if someone tried to make the comparison that Jesus made and go back to 1 Samuel 21 to justify their assertion that, hey, it's okay for us to pick this grain, they might, good Church of Christ, I'd probably raise my hand and be like, "It's not really the same thing. You know, this is not these are kind of apples to oranges. I don't really see anything about the Sabbath in that story in 1 Samuel. I'm not really talking about the Sabbath. It's kind of a big deal. It's kind of on the Ten Commandments. You know, these are not really the same thing, Jesus. Couldn't you have found a better text? Couldn't you have found something that would make those connections much clearer?" Right? Because this one's kind of a stretch. Now, I mean, all kidding aside, it's a little rude to say to Jesus, but I think that that's something we need to take seriously. We need to take seriously that a lot of times, the way Jesus refers to the Old Testament or his scripture and the way he understands those texts would not fly in one of our classes. And that's something that we really need to wrestle with. What's going on with that? And that's another pin we'll stick in something. You guys take that home and think about it. Jesus is, I think, not as concerned about one-to-one connection as he is about a correlation. And the correlation I think Jesus is highlighting here is about law, right? So what they're saying is, well, first of all, let's just take a minute and see that he says, have you never read? Which is so snarky. I love that. You know, he's just poking at him. But he says, why, the Pharisees say, why are they doing what is not lawful? And then he comes down, and Jesus, the way he reads the text, he points out that what it is that they did, that David did, was also not lawful. Right? So he's arguing with them about when it's okay to break the law. Right? Which might make us all a little uncomfortable, but let's just hang on for a second. I'm actually not going to make that less uncomfortable, but that's all right. So he is talking about when do you break the law, right? Whether it's the law about who can have access to the bread of the presence and who can have access to the grain in the field. And apparently, it's when someone needs it, right? When the human need, when you look at those texts about what is lawful or not, and you read them through the human need for food, the human need takes precedence over the law, right? And I think we can take this idea and even go, next chapter, he enters the synagogue, and there's a man who had a withered hand, and they watched him to see whether he would cure him on the Sabbath, we're still on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, come forward. Then he said to them, is it lawful to do good? Because he's already anticipating what they're going to say, right? Or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save a life or to kill. But they were silent. They're just waiting. And he looked around at them with anger. He was grieved at their hardness of heart and said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against him how to destroy him. So, he doesn't actually specifically cite scripture in this text, but I think the text just before it, the same scripture applies, right? Because what's happened here, and again, a good Church of Christ are sitting in our Sunday school class, seeing this situation, say, well, Jesus, I mean, the guy, he probably had a withered hand for a long time. I mean, he's not dying. You know, wouldn't it be more respectful? Wouldn't it be more like honoring the Sabbath, you know, keeping it holy, if you just waited till tomorrow? You know, what's the big deal? Just wait till tomorrow. Jesus is having none of that, right? It's not about a life or death situation in this situation. It's about just doing good. It's about the human need in front of him and reading the law about the Sabbath through the human need in front of him. And in that situation, being holy, you could argue that he keeping the Sabbath, he's reinterpreting that to say keeping the Sabbath is doing good to the human being in front of you. Or, you know, if you want to go a little farther with it, you can say you can break the law in that situation. But, and even if looking at this, we can even back up and we go back to chapter 1. And we see that Jesus has never been concerned about this tension. It has always been human first, right? Because the first thing he does is he exorcises a demon in a synagogue on the Sabbath. And then he goes in to Peter's house, or mother-in-law's house, and she's got a fever, and he fixes that. And the tension is clear because nobody else seems to quite be doing it the way Jesus is. The text tells us that everybody shows up to bring him people to heal after the Sabbath. Everybody else waits, right? Jesus doesn't wait. He responds to the human need that is present in front of him. I would really love to go into a lot more text than this. But I'm hopeful that this makes some of the point of how Landon's argument that he is, in fact, reading his Bible the way Jesus read his Bible, that has some merit, right? Absolutely does. And just as an aside, something that we just really don't have time to go into, Landon's strategy of teaching without explicitly referencing Scripture, Landon's strategy of teaching without maybe mentioning God, right? Going into these places without his Bible. I want you to think when you go home and look back at the parables. Look at the parables and see, is that really not talking about Scripture? Are the parables really not communicating Scripture? I think they are. Even though they don't cite them explicitly, even though they may not use the word God. And they are some of the most effective teaching methods that Jesus or anyone else has ever used, right? Because he took something present in the real lived context of a human being. And without cluttering it up with anything else, expressed it to someone so that the truth of Scripture, the weight of Scripture correlated to it, was revealed. Right? Does that make sense? All right. I know I'm giving you a couple of things to just take home. So hopefully some of that is helpful. So what I want to do now that we've kind of established that there is some merit to Landon's argument that he is reading his Scripture the way Jesus read his Scripture, I want to try to actually take this method as we've looked at it, these sets of assumptions, these driving questions, and I want to apply them to an actual situation. Because one of the things that I think is most important about doing this class, and I said this yesterday, is not just that I think this is fun. I'm not trying to just be informative. I actually think and really believe that the way that Landon has been and continues to engage with Scripture and engage with the world is something that the world needs and that we need. And so I want very, very much for you to be able to take some of these strategies, to go home and not just say, isn't it cool how Landon reads Scripture? I want you to be able to say, maybe I can read Scripture that way too. Let's talk about this in my home congregation. Is this a way that we might want to read Scripture? How could this benefit us? How could this connect us to the outsider in pain or the one in our midst? Right? Okay. So what I want to do... Yes. So what I want to do now, in order to actually use Landon's method, we have to actually talk about people, right? Real people in a real context. And so I'm going to tell a story. It is not my story, and I want everyone to understand that I have, in fact, asked permission from all the people to share the story in the way that I'm going to, because I think that's important. And I also want to say very clearly that the goal here, by placing human beings in front of you in the way that we're about to, is not to be emotionally manipulative. Okay? I think sometimes that is the accusation. And I think that that can absolutely be true, and that's something we need to be careful about. I also think that can be an excuse not to do the hard work of looking in the face of another human being in pain. We want to abstract away from that. We want to say, okay, let's not talk about the person. Let's talk about the issue, right? And we distance ourselves from how hard it is because it's so much easier. But I think what Landon is saying is we got to stop doing that. Because Jesus, it's not about issues. It's about the person. It's about the human being in front of you. And you need to have the courage to look that person in the eye and be present with that person in his or her pain, no matter how uncomfortable that makes you. I will tell you, this is about to make me uncomfortable, but I think it's important. This is a beautiful family. This is my family. This is my cousin Jenny, and she is one of my best friends in the entire world. That's her husband Mark. Three of her children. On the right is Sydney, in the middle is Julia, and over here is Isaac. Cohen is along now, but this is back in 2011, and Cohen wasn't born yet. In this story, Julia, in the middle there, her name's Julia Grace, she was born on November 30th, 2010, with a condition that caused her an extra chromosome, an extra 18th chromosome. It's called trisomy 18, or Edwards syndrome, if you have heard of it. It's a very medically difficult situation. A large portion of these children do not survive to birth, and when they do, most of them do not survive past their first year. Julia lived a little over a year in this family, and I don't want to go into the details of all of that because the story is really about Sydney. But before we move to Sydney, I do want to say that Julia brought joy to this family and was covered with love. So what I want to do is talk about two sisters. So when Julia was born in 2010, Sydney was six, and she had Julia as her little sister for a little over a year, until she was seven. And I kind of think their smiles are a little similar. Mm-hmm. And Sydney, she was aware enough to know a lot of what was happening, both the joys of having her little sister and the struggle of having a sister with the kinds of needs that Julia had. She helped her family, she helped her mom, and it was hard when Julia passed away for Sydney, as it was for everyone, but we're focusing on Sydney right now. She's a pretty great big sister. So the story specifically that I want to tell is about a year after, within a year of Julia's death. So I think Sydney would have been about eight. The Childress family was at church, and the sermon was on the testing of the Israelites in the wilderness. And you've probably heard this sermon many times, where the preacher says to the congregation, God is the struggle and the pain and everything that's going on with these Israelites is because God is testing them the same way God tests us with challenges, with difficulties. We're also being tested. And sitting there, eight-year-old Sydney turns to her mother and said, does that mean that Julia was our test? So I want to hang on to that moment and that question, right? This is the moment and the question, looking at her, that we're going to take to the text. Okay? So what does the book of Mark, right? Because I don't want to just jump to something that is an easy, I don't want to cherry pick an easy question. I want to inhabit the text the way that Landon talks about. Enter into the text. Be oriented by standing in that sacred space of the text with this. So when we inhabit that text and we ask ourselves, what is it really that she's asking? I think that she is asking, fundamentally, was Julia fully human? Was Julia the subject of her own life, or was she merely an object for our testing? I think that that is what she's asking, because I think that that is what the language of that preacher's sermon is implying. that people can be objects. And I think that's where her grief right there may be lying. And so I go into the Gospel of Mark, and I get there right there at the beginning, and Jesus comes into contact in chapter 1 with a leper, and heals the leper, and then tells the leper something that comes up over and over again in the Gospel of Mark. Jesus tells the leper, "Don't tell anybody." Now, in academic circles, or maybe you've heard this before, you might have heard of the messianic secret in Mark. And if you've read Mark, you will notice that Jesus is constantly telling, performing miracles, helping people, and then saying, "Don't tell anybody what just happened." Which is really weird, right? It's so weird that the other ones don't do it, right? And so we have this running motif, right, of don't tell anybody, don't tell anybody. Now, as I go into, now, if I look at that messianic secret, and I'm looking at it from a behind-the-text perspective, right, a historical, critical perspective, I'm going to start saying, do we think that really goes back to the historical Jesus? Did Jesus really say to people, you know, don't tell anybody? Does that sound like something Jesus would say? Does that make sense? Let's look at our sources. Let's look at, let's do all kinds of different elements of redaction criticism, and let's look at textual criticism and see what's most likely, what's going to fit here. What would the original author have been thinking by doing that? What does it communicate? What would the original audience have heard, right? You would ask all those kinds of questions, and none of those questions speak to Sydney, because I don't think they do. They're interesting. I geek out on those kinds of questions all the time. But those questions are located in a particular world and place, and they're not alive where Sydney is. Now, if you were an in-the-text person, if you were asking those kinds of questions, you would be looking at, say, the narrative of Mark and saying, well, how does the motif of the messianic secret, how does that function in the narrative? What's the narrative arc of the book, and how does the motif interact with that narrative arc to show us how Jesus is revealed and hidden? You know, let's look at motifs of blindness and sight and all of those kinds of things to understand better what the mystery of Jesus' identity might mean within that narrative. Fascinating. Love that stuff. But it doesn't speak to Sydney, right? But if we stand in front of the text with her, asking what does it mean to be present with her in her real, lived, flesh and blood question, looking through her at the messianic secret, we can see that, you know what? Jesus affirms the subject quality, the fully human quality of each one of those people he interacts with when he doesn't make them into objects or tools for his fame and his glory. When he says, nope, don't tell anybody. What happened is just between us. You're not my message. You are not an object for me. Now, someone behind the text who reads behind the text might say, I'm not sure that has anything to do with what Jesus was really trying to do. Someone who's reading in the text would say, you know what? I don't think that necessarily works with the narrative goals of that. But for Landon, doesn't make it any less true. Right? Because we can now, standing oriented by Mark and that messianic secret, and Jesus constantly affirming over and over again, you aren't a tool for me. You are not merely an object. You are fully human, and I am present with you in your humanity. We can be with Sydney in that way, and we can affirm to her that Julia was absolutely fully human. She wasn't a tool used by God, or anybody else. She was her own person who lived and breathed and smiled and brought joy and some sorrow. And you, Sydney, you are not an object either. You are not a tool. You and your grief and who you are becoming, that is something beautiful. It is the image of God, which you bear just like your sister did. Now that is a reading that I think matters in the world right now. But it's also a reading that's hard. It's hard. So, as we're coming here to the end of our time, I want to come back to this statement that Landon made. Because this has been about Landon's hermeneutic. How does Landon read the text? What does he think Scripture is? Landon says, I treasure our emphasis on the text. And in some of his lectures, you will hear him say, I don't know how to value Scripture more than I do. It has saved my life. I am quoting him. But I do not treasure an idolatrous view of Scripture that removes the centrality of a human being. If we had stuck with some of those other readings, we would have lost the centrality of Sydney in that moment. She would have been swept to the side. The religious of Jesus' day interpreted Scripture in a way that justified filling their hands with rocks to kill a woman. That justifies a preacher standing up, doing his best, and saying, and communicating to an 8-year-old that her sister that she has lost is not fully human and is in fact just an object for God to test Sydney. Scripture was in their mouths, Scripture in the mouth. And again, I want to emphasize, Scripture in the mouth, not in the world, right? Justified slavery. Scripture in the mouth condemned divorced people and excluded them from fellowship. When the world comes to us in a person we love, a human being for whom Christ died, we're not abandoning Scripture. We don't abandon Scripture. When I'm speaking to Sydney in that moment, I'm not abandoning Scripture. Just because I don't read it the way that someone in the ancient world might have read it. Instead, for that moment, in that interaction of being fully present with Sydney, like Jesus tried to be fully present and was fully present, in that moment, I believe we see Scripture more clearly. Because it spoke life to her. And if the Scripture is not alive in our churches, in our world, then what in the world good is it? Other than to get dusty on a shelf or let some of us geek out over the ins and outs of different kinds of exegetical questions. But if it's not in the world, if it's not alive in the world through us, it's useless. So, I want to come back to the plea that I made. So, at the beginning of our first class yesterday, gosh, that was just yesterday. Okay, at the beginning of that class, I talked about the fact that this, and I think it's pretty clear to all of you, is not just an educational exercise for me. This is something I'm passionate about. And I feel honored to communicate. And that at the center of what I'm trying to bring here is a plea. And it is a plea that I think is the plea that Landon has been making year after year after year. And I talked about Star Wars and the Rogue One film where the heroine, one of the characters, says to the heroine, "How can you live with Imperial flags flying over your head?" And she says, "It's not a problem if you don't look up." And Landon has been saying, look up. For the sake of God and the world, look up. And look into the face of the human being across from you and be present, even if that's hard, even if that's painful. Because that's what matters to God. If you fail there in that relationship, if we fail with the human being, we failed at everything, according to Landon. Now, it's interesting, because after yesterday, my sister's walking down the hall, and she hears someone singing a little song, and it is a song from Les Mis, and the person starts singing, and the words are, "Look down, look down." So I don't know how familiar you are with the show, but they're towards the beginning when Jean Valjean is a prisoner. Mm-hmm. Look down is the song that the prisoners are singing about their plight. And it's a song that communicates what it means to not be human in the world, to be treated as less than human. Look down, don't look him in the eye. Look down, you're here till you die. And you go further on. He says, "I stole a loaf of bread." That's it, right? And he's told, and he's like, "And now I'm free." And they say, "No, you're not free. You'll carry that shame till you die. Look down, look down." And so in addition, I think, to the plea to look up, because it's what we're called to do, what God calls us to do, look up, because looking down takes away your humanity. We are fully human when we look up. It's not just about what we do, what we're doing for the other. We're doing something for ourselves. We are looking up at the world, at the person across from us, the way Jesus did. And we are fully human in that action. And I want to leave on our last minute here with this, coming back to this view of Scripture. Now, I suggested to everyone that I thought a good way of thinking about how Landon views Scripture in the Bible was as sacred space. And we talked about, and we looked at the chapel, pictures of the chapel here on campus, and how you could go in that space and it orients you, and it's different depending on the light or the time of day, what you're looking at in the chapel space, whether it's full of people or it's not, right? This is called the Roofless Church. It is in New Harmony, Indiana, and it is across the street from the park dedicated to Paul Tillich, where Paul Tillich's ashes were spread. And I think I mentioned yesterday the influence of Paul Tillich on Landon. I want to suggest that we think about Scripture as a roofless church. When we stand in that sacred space, that sacred space is still open to the elements. Everything that happens to the world around it happens inside it. Right? When the wind blows, when the storms come through, it's inside there the same way it's outside. I want to suggest that we open the Scripture to the elements. That we open the text to the elements, that we take the roof off. And we inhabit that space. And we allow the world and the text to come together in a way that truly embodies the image of God for transformation in the world. That is all the time I have. I hope we've made some suggestions here that you can take home with you, that you can continue to think about, and that any of you who feel as passionate as I do about the work of Landon in the world. Let's keep going with it, because we need to hear it. Thank you for being here.